Thank you guys for having me. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, my name's Robin. I'm an alcoholic and I'm a drug addict. I got sober on October 5th of 2018, and I share a sobriety date, not a year, with Chris. And when you first come in and get sober, that's like a really cool thing when you see somebody that has what I want. I'll take like fucking anything as a sign and hold on to that. So I got sober a couple of years ago, and I love when people tell their stories. It was like my favorite thing in the beginning, and it's my favorite thing now. So when somebody asks me to do this, I like to say yes. I was thinking about it, like, why do I like to tell my story? I used to talk to absolutely nobody. My shades were drawn, and the less human interaction that I could have, the better. So why do I like to do this now? My sponsor would tell me that it's my ego, and I believe her, because I believe anything that my sponsor says pretty much, or that she, because I can't see myself and she can see me. But also, like, when I was sitting in treatment, you know, treatment was great for, like, arresting my drug use. AA keeps me sober. And when people came to my treatment center and told stories, and I heard that, like, deep, deep pain that they were in, and then that high hope. And then, like, right after they told their stories, and I would see them laughing afterward and then planning where to go to dinner. That was incredibly attractive to me. And I just couldn't fucking believe it, that you could have both things at the same time. And that really drew me and attracted me to AA. And I wanted to have that, and I didn't know how, so I kept watching people. And that's my story today, which I never in the beginning believed that I could have that, but I kept watching and listening. And that's why I like to tell my story, because it worked for me. So yeah, I'll just, I get kind of nervous doing this thing. So I like to say that at the beginning, because I know that when I speak, what I'm feeling out loud and share that with people in the program, it takes the power out of it. So yeah, I'm nervous. I still get nervous, scared, depressed, all of those things. And so, yeah, I'll just start from the beginning. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, to a mom, dad, two older brothers, and an older sister. So I'm the baby. And the kind of household that I grew up in, we didn't talk about anything. I am the only alcoholic and drug addict in my family, except for a grandfather who is an alcoholic who shot himself dead. But nobody ever talked about that, and that was a running theme in my family. I always felt like I was born sad, like if you could grab a flag on the way in, that's the one that I grabbed, and I held on to that. If you cried in my family, it was like you got 5 minutes. If you were sad, you had to get over it. If you're upset, you had to get over it. And if you were sick, you got 5 minutes. That was the message that I heard loud and clear, and I took it really, really seriously. And it was, you know, get over it and go study. Education was really, really pushed in my family. And that, for me, manifested, like, not only emotionally, but also physically. I was a migrainer from a very young age, so I probably got my first migraine around like 12 or 13 years old. And that's when I got my first prescription of painkillers, and I loved them. I have a friend in the program that says, why did I take drugs? Because they were fucking delicious. And that's how I felt about them too. I had painkillers in my pocket from the time that I was 12 or 13 until the time that I walked into treatment for the first time at age 42. And I would just stuff as many as I thought I needed in my pocket for the day. And that's what I did, kept them a secret for my entire life. So the pattern kind of was that I would get a migraine as a kid. I would throw up. I would take drugs, and I would tell no one, and then I would just keep going about my day. Then I would go back to the doctor. I would get more. And that's what I did. And I kept it to myself along with like everything else. So growing up, like I had a best friend who died and I couldn't stop crying. And my dad said, stop dying with him. And that's what I did. He said, go study. And so that's what I did. When I had a best friend who was molested when I was a kid, she told me to keep a secret. That's what I did. When the same happened to me as a kid, I kept it a secret too. My emotions, I just kept to myself. Like when that friend died when I was a kid, I took all of my anger that I felt toward my dad. I took his obituary. I took sadness and every other emotion, and I shoved them in my pocket along with those pills. And that's how I walked around as a kid and as I grew up. So, yeah, I started using drugs and alcohol at a very young age, but kind of even looking backward a little bit, I always behaved alcoholically. So when I first learned to read, I think you do that around in kindergarten or something. When we're like going around in a circle learning to read and it came to my turn, I can very much remember like this pitter patter and I passed out. And my family took me to the doctor to have me checked for epilepsy. So I had all these, I think it was an EEG or an EKG, I'm not sure which one that is, but I remember them putting those, whatever they're called, on my brain to test me and thinking to myself, even at that very young age, like, doctors, you got the wrong organ, like something's wrong with my heart. And I remember learning to write just a little bit later. And I wrote so small on the page. I wanted to disappear. I didn't want anybody to know what I was doing. I didn't want anybody to see me. And my parents sent me to a handwriting specialist to learn how to write bigger. And like a very good alcoholic, I wrote bigger, but I just picked up a pencil and I wrote lighter. So still nobody could see what I was doing. In fifth grade, like elementary school age, I was a bully. I had a project in school and it was like a baking cookies kind of thing. Had flour left over in my locker. And, you know, I must have like watched, I think it was friend's parents or something, and started to snort it in the bathroom and then tried to start selling it at school. So, you know, I was a bad kid, started doing that kind of thing and not having any consequences because in my home, we just didn't talk about anything. And then in middle school, started drinking. And high school, started drugging, and then went to college. College was really, really fun. Met a small group of friends, and we studied really hard. I did well in school. And so we would study all day. We would drink all night, come back, pass out, and do it over and over again. And my migraines were pretty relentless during this time and just didn't talk about it. And at the end of college was also when I got my first real bout of depression. And it was, I think, in like junior year. And I really didn't know what was happening. And I just know it went on for about 3 weeks. And it was a time when like I didn't think anybody was watching. And I think I probably spent about 3 weeks in my room. You know, it wasn't like a long thing, relatively speaking, but it was something that was very noticeable to me. And one day my best friend's brother walked in and he said, you know, it's a gift to be able to feel that way. And that was one of those moments in my life that gave me hope. And it was one of like many moments when I thought like nobody was watching, but gave me the ability to pick myself up and sort of move on. And was just something that I hung on to, like a small victory or a little firefly, a little spark, that made me think that like there was hope for me in this life. The migraines kept coming. I didn't know what I wanted to do after college. And the night of my graduation, my family had driven up and we were outside on the back of a deck and watching the sun go down. And my dad said to me, we've talked about it as a family and we've decided you should go to law school. And I thought to myself, what the fuck? That was like nowhere in the realm of possibilities for me. And he said, I don't want you to burn your heart out trying to help people that don't want your help. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And my thought at that time was, you know what? Like, if you know me so well, why haven't you talked to me? And in response to that, I said goodbye to my family, like they were going their way for the night. And in response to that, I went and took a hit of ecstasy. And that became a real pattern for me. It was, you know, using drugs as a fuck you to everybody that, you know, I was angry at in this world. And I did go to law school. So it was, you know, one presentation on the outside and a lot of rage and anger on the inside. So I moved back to Michigan where my parents were and I started studying for the LSATs. My dad got very sick. He got diagnosed with cancer and he was given a year and a half to live. That was extremely difficult for me. The way my family handled that was to look at it in the most positive light they could. It was, let's rally, let's do this. Nobody ever talked about how painful cancer was. And so I started ordering pills off the internet. You could order them in large quantities at that time, and that's what I did. So my pill use started going from like a little handful that was in my pocket to ordering 300 pills a month. I don't know what I was taking. Like, you know, I thought I was ordering, you know, Vicodin, Oxy, whatever it was. And I'm not sure what it was, but it was in large quantities. I applied to law school. I got in. I moved out west to Portland, which was like a dream city for me. And I did well in law school. And the pill use was out of control. And so were my migraines. They sort of went hand in hand. And my dad did live for a year and a half. And as he was dying, I went back to Michigan for the summer that he was extremely sick and dying. And where my drug use had taken me at that point was in Michigan on the day that he was dying, when he was taking his last breath and my whole family was holding his hand. I was in the next room, using and throwing up. And, that's what powerlessness was for me as I now understand it. That's nothing I would have ever been able to talk about before I got into AA and worked the steps. Way too shameful, way too disgusting for me to be able to look myself in the mirror. And now I can hold my head up high only because of AA and tell you, that I wasn't with my dad when he died because of my drug use. So after my dad died, I went back to Portland. I finished law school. I did really well and I got my dream job. I didn't know that, kids had lawyers too. And so my job was representing kids in the foster care system and their parents. And that was a fucking fabulous job. I would have told you the entire time that I represented those kids and those parents that it was the greatest job. It was the best. It wasn't difficult. I had, you know, the best people to work with. And now I can tell you it was extremely emotionally taxing. It was incredibly difficult and painful. I saw a lot of things that were really difficult to see. And my drug use was highly, highly exacerbated because I couldn't take it. There was a lot of pain in that. I did love that job, and I also felt a lot of things as a result, and took drugs all along. Not because of it. I mean, I'm an addict through and through, but it didn't help. Let's just say. So my migraines went hand in hand with that, and my migraines got really, really out of control. I worked at a firm for 5 years, and then another dream of mine got fulfilled. I opened my own firm with two best friends of mine doing the same kind of work. And about 3 years into that, one day I got a migraine and it didn't go away. So it was like 8 days I'd get a migraine, and then maybe I'd get a day off, and then about 25 days long there'd be a migraine. And I'd still be going to court, but I'd be like, you know, doing drugs in the car beforehand. I'd be asking judges if I could use their chambers. I'd be doing drugs in judges' chambers before and after trial on my way down to the Court of Appeals. And, you know, that could only last for so long. And I had a total, complete, like, emotional, psychological, physical breakdown. And my family intervened and they said, we're going to move you back to Michigan. We're going to make getting treatment your job. And this was for migraines because they didn't know about the drug use. So I, at that point, I had hit my dog and rehomed him. I sold my practice. I sold my condo and moved back to Detroit to try to get well from my migraines. And I did that. I was still using heavily. And about, I don't know, a year and a half in, I found treatment for my migraines and they went away. It was unbelievable to go from 3 years of straight migraines to not a migraine in sight. And I packed up my bags and I moved back to Portland, Oregon as fast as I could. And it was amazing. I wasn't having migraines. I got my independence back. I was flying high. I was drinking, going out every night. I was having the best sex of my life. It was incredible until one day the treatment failed. And I was back in bed. I looked at myself and I said, there's no way that I'm going back to that dark place. I'm not doing it all over again. And I told no one that the treatment had failed. And I picked up the phone and I got my first sack of cocaine. I had read in like a small, this was the intellectual that I thought I was. I had found a small footnote in like an old medical journal that said they used to treat migraines with cocaine. So I thought that that was going to be the solution for me. And so, you know, my first call was 2 grams, and then, you know, it was up to 10 grams every 3 days. I was snorting so hard and so fast, I cracked a rib. I was chipping teeth. I was peeing blood. It was, my life spun completely out of control. I was working a new job at this time, and I was really involved. I was, at this point, I had taught myself a new field of law, doing contests and sweepstakes for celebrities, raising money for charity. And at this point, like, I was staying up all night. You know, it was like 3 nights on, and then I would crash. I would be nowhere to be found. The job was kind of the last thing to go. But yeah, my life just spun out of control. And my brothers owned the company with a couple of actors. And one day I got a call from my brothers and they said, we've got some good news and some bad news. They said the good news is we sold the company, and the bad news is if you want to keep working for us, you've got to move to San Diego. And I said, thank God, because I could not stop using. Like, I was trying everything I could. I would try to save up a bunch of pills to wean off the cocaine. I would try, taking a bunch of Molly so I wouldn't go anywhere near the cocaine. I was trying to throw myself in the bathtub to get physically wet so I wouldn't snort anymore. I was calling the police on myself. It was just a fucking mess. So I thought I could move to San Diego because we know that there are no drugs down there. And I would move in with my brother, his wife, and his kids. And if I'm around them, then I won't use and I can get sober. I really believed it with all of my heart. So I moved down there about 6 months later. I had saved up a bunch of pills because I thought if I could move down there and I would wean myself off the pills slowly when I got there so it wouldn't be so painful. When I got down there, I had taken the pills so fast that my body became toxic and I couldn't keep any down. And so I was at work one day and I stole a bunch of pills from my brother, and what I thought were Tramadol were actually Valium. And I had taken a handful and I started to sway at my desk. And so I said to the guy next to me, who was a relative stranger, I had just started this job. I said, can you call me an Uber? I got to get home now. I can't drive myself. And he did. And so I got in that Uber. And the next thing I know, I have been, I wake up with a meth pipe in my mouth and I'm in a hotel and I've been molested by the Uber driver. And when I had the chance to leave or go ask for some help, I didn't, because the Uber driver was going to go get better drugs and I wanted to stay there with him, because I wanted to use. And, like now I know again that that's what powerlessness is, and that it's not my fault. I kept that to myself for a really, really long time because it was unspeakable for me that I would stay in a situation like that, instead of ask for help. Another one of those where I just could not look at myself. But it is, thank God for it, because it is what propelled me into treatment. Soon after that, I was living, with my brother and his wife. Soon after that, I had put so much Adderall up my nose that my lips turned blue. And I picked up the phone. I called 911 and I hung up the phone again and said, I really don't want to die. Like, I had thought about it so many times. And when the time came and I had a moment of clarity, I picked up the phone again and I called my brother and his wife, and I said, can you guys come home? And I told him everything, and that's when my family intervened, and I had told them everything, and I got to go to treatment, and I went to treatment in Driftwood, Texas. And nobody wanted it more than me. So a couple months later, I got on a flight and I came to Driftwood, and I came down to a program. They have a pain program and they have a substance abuse program, which was perfect for me at the time. I got to say I'm a migrainer who uses drugs. And I had not admitted yet that I was an alcoholic and an addict. So I went through that program and I went to their aftercare, and I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I worked them intellectually, as I had done everything else in my life. hadn't made that journey down to my heart. And I made one friend. I went to meetings. And after I had left extended care, I went to my own apartment because that's what 43-year-olds do. They go to their own apartment. And I, I was going to meetings every day, worked the steps. I got to step 12 and, my sponsor said to me, I'd like to start sponsoring. And I thought to myself, I have like nothing to give to another person. I have nothing to transmit. I have not done this thing yet. And the one friend that I made, he went back to LA and I felt totally alone. I had made friends with no one. I didn't know what a fellowship was. And one day I got a call from that friend's mom and she said, there's no good way to tell you this, but Paul is dead. And I fell to my knees and said, why me? Like another fucking thing in my life. And I found the nearest person I could to start using with, and I went out and I smoked heroin for about 3 months. I had had a taste of AA, and it was the only thing that I had ever tried that made sense to me. And I felt like I had heard about step one experiences, and I like mentioned a couple times here about powerlessness, but real powerlessness to me, like for the first time, was when I ran out of heroin. I had never felt anything like that before. Paul was dead. And for the first time, I didn't know, like I wanted to get back to the rooms. And it wasn't my choice anymore. The drug was stronger than me. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it back. I know... I got a phone call the morning that I was detoxing from somebody from my rehab. She said, how are you doing? And I said, not so good. I said, I want to go back to treatment. And I didn't think there was a shot in the world. She called my family. And by the grace of God, I made it back. My sponsee asked me the other day, what's the difference between the first time you went to treatment and the second time that you went to treatment? And the first time that I went, like, I was ready for it. I was 5 minutes early to everything. I worked it like I worked school, and I wanted to get a good grade. The owner of the treatment center said, why don't you come work here sometime? When I went back the second time, I was a frightened little baby. I was scared to death. The first question that I asked was like, What do you do when shitty things happen? Like, I do not know how to live. My entire guard was let down. I was rocking back and forth. I was 87 pounds. And I wasn't thinking about work. I wasn't thinking about, you know, the things that I was when I came in the first time. And I needed help. I needed a lot of help, and I didn't even know where to begin. They said, how are you feeling? I said, I don't even know what a feeling is. Can you give me an example of one? They said, what are your emotions like today? I said, I don't know. Can you tell me what an emotion is? I hadn't felt anything, and I knew nothing. I was ready to learn. And I opened my ears. I listened. I started to, like, observe and really slow down. I Worked with my same sponsor and started to get into the steps, which I had worked before, but really not at all. I believed in God, but I didn't ask. Like, I thought that there was something out there that was bigger than me, but really it was just like another way to blame my family. When I thought about God before I came in this time, I immediately thought like, yeah, like I would think about resentments toward my family for how I grew up and how they treated religion. This time I thought about, okay, what questions can I ask? And how do you pray? And people would hold my hands and show me what they did. And that made sense to me. And for a little bit, you know, I didn't know what to believe. I didn't know what it was. And so I clung to the belief that other people in AA believed. And that was enough for me. Like, this book was written so long ago and it worked for so many people that I just leaned into that. And that was steps 2 and 3 for me. And then I got into my 4th step. And this time I wrote everything down. The first time I wrote, I watched the clock for my sponsor. And I wrote what I thought that she would have time for. I hit the highlights, like dad died. I didn't like my sister, so I didn't think I should even put her on there. Like, who had time for that? And this time I wrote every single thing that ever bothered me. You know, I grew up thinking that small things didn't matter, and small things did matter to me. And so I put them all down, and we went through my 5th step. And it was magic for me to be able to connect with somebody like that. Nobody had ever treated me like that before, and to be able to connect like that, you know, we laughed a little bit. There was a lot of eye contact. It was unbelievable. I just never felt like that before. And after my 4th or my 5th step, since that time, I have not gotten a serious migraine. And it's been well over 2 years. After that, you know, I started to remember things that had happened that I hadn't written down on my 5th step. And I was driving one day, and I was in like extended care at this time. And I started to remember something, and I started crying and went back into the house and found a couple people in there. And I said, I remembered something. Can I talk to you? And I just started crying to them and telling them some other things that were like 4-step type things. And one of them sat there and listened, and tears welled up. And the other one put her hands on my shoulders, and she looked at me and she said, you're safe now. And that was really a beginning for me to really feel safe in the world and to trust and to get honest about every single thing that I had. Every single thing. I mean, now I don't keep anything to myself. Honesty is like the foundation of my program. I don't make decisions by myself. And it was the beginning of like me making a fellowship. It was also the beginning of me making a connection with a higher power. And I don't know what it is. I just know it's, you know, sometimes it's just not me. Other times it's the group. And a lot of times it is like divine intervention or just divine. But a lot of times it's just connection. Other times it's just being able to pause and back up and get perspective. It's just sort of loose for me. I moved to sober living. You know, the first time that I went through this program, they recommended sober living, and I didn't even hear them this time. And still, I take everybody's suggestions. I can't see myself clearly. I can't see myself at all, in fact. But if I tell everybody in the fellowship the truth and the same things and have no secrets, no matter what room I walk into, I can rely on other people to help me see myself. Anyway, I took the suggestion of going to Sober Living, and I lived there for a year and 9 months, first as a client and then as a house manager, and it was the best thing that I ever did. I don't need to live alone, nor do I want to. And it was an amazing experience. I used to, when I first got there, I wanted to leave so badly. I mean, I'm a person who lives in a black and white world, or grew up in a black and white world. And I'm a person who, you know, at the first opportunity I would run. And when I got there, that's what I wanted to do. The shower was broken, so conveniently I could leave and go back to the last place I was living, and wouldn't have to stay there until they sat me down and they said, "We want you to stay." And, you know, that was, all of these instances were like, you know, that's what AA has been for me, is learning that, that I don't have to run away from these things, and learning to trust other people and to lean in and stop running away from life and to start like living in reality. I'm not sure how much time we have left. Okay, cool. When I was in that house with many other women, it was great to live in a women's house, to find out, it was just great to be around all other women. I learned a lot about myself and my patterns, and I still am. But I got to, instead of run from those relationships, write a lot of inventory. It's a great tool to let other people be human, let myself be human, work through things, learn how to communicate instead of just sabotage relationships like I had done so much in the past. I learned that writing inventory is the best thing I can do for another person, or the kindest thing I can do for another person. It's been awesome to like grow relationships instead of run and sabotage all of them, or want to be alone. The amends process has been really cool also. Especially, you know, the one that I could point to the most is like with my sister. She wasn't on my fourth step in the beginning because I thought I didn't like her. She's probably the person that I care about the most, that I hurt the most. And when I did my amends with her, she said, "Could I read you a poem?" And the poem she had written after a bad night. It was my mom's 70th birthday party, and I had acted, you know, in my addiction, and I wasn't okay. And she wrote a poem, and it was called "She's Fucking Sick." And, you know, poetry is beautiful, right? To me. And for her to write a very, very angry poem, but still write a poem that's beautiful, it just sort of, you know, along with everything else that I was doing, it said to me that, like, love isn't this shiny ideal thing, and neither is life. And it's lots of different things. Love sometimes looks like anger, and people get angry at the people that they love. And that's what life is. And I try to think about that a lot, and try to like lean into my relationships, and my relationship with my sister and my family is wonderful compared to what it was. With just, I guess, a few minutes left, I COVID, I try to stay really close to the program. It's shown me even more how fragile life is. I know that mine is. Today, I really care about mine. There was my whole life I didn't, and today I do, which is a miracle for me, and I treat it like I do. You know, all life I had really good intentions, and I was never, ever able to follow through, and today I can. I just got back from a walk with a really close friend, and I wasn't thinking about what happened yesterday or 20 years ago. And I'm not thinking about what happened tomorrow, and sitting here with you, there's no place I'd rather be. I have to remind myself a lot that the point of this program is not so I can get better. It's so that I can stop living in that black and white world that I thought it was. And so that I can have like a range of emotions and lots of experiences and not do them alone, not rely on myself, and actually like have a life that I care about and enjoy those things, and not like seek out the high, high highs and the low, low lows, but enjoy the simple things and just like be present with you guys. So I'm really, really grateful for this program and for, you know, my home group and for AR. I love AR. I'll just wrap up with this one story, is that being at 1313 and taking meetings out to AR the first time I did that, I told my story. And at the end of it, I was sort of wrapping up. I was newly sober and I said something, something, something. And I'm really stubborn. And somebody, one of the women there said, "You think?" And I am so thankful for that, because again, I can't see myself clearly. And that has stuck with me today. I mean, when people tell me things about myself and I can handle the truth now, it helps me grow. So I'm really happy to be here. And thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, Robin. I love that story.
Thank you, Robin. Wow. Yeah, that was great. Thanks a bunch.
Yeah. That was amazing, dude.
Thank
you. It was a very moving story, and you did a wonderful job telling it.
I appreciate it.